think everybody's here. Hope you had a nice lunch. Don't fall asleep. I'll try my best to keep you awake. It's a terrible time, of course, the lecture after lunch, huh? So you're fighting against metabolism. You'll see later on why I called this lecture the Metabolic Marketplace, but I'm hoping that the term will become apparent as the lecture goes on. So, in biochemistry for a century, we've been building maps. Started off with a metabolic map, all the reactions and intermediary metabolism, and of course lately all the genetic regulatory maps, and we are very good map builders. But as Count Alfred Korzybski said here in the middle of the previous century, the map is not the territory. And what we really should be trying to understand is the territory. So I've coming from South Africa, where we have, of course, the beautiful rock paintings by the Sun people. This is a trace of dancers around a fire. And to me, it's a nice picture of what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand the dance of the cell. And, of course, how cells dance with each other. But I'm inside the cell now, so I want to see how the molecules dance with each other. What I propose to do is to divide the lecture into two parts. The first part dealing with supply-demand analysis, which will build on the concepts that I introduced in my tutorial on metabolic control analysis. And I'll discuss such things as functional context and organization and differentiation. And in the second part, I'll have a look at metabolic regulation and the view that we propose, which is directly opposed to the classical view of regulation. And I'll do that in terms of a model of a typically regulated metabolic subsystem. And what I think I should do is to give part one, and if you could, I mean, unless you really have a question that is desperate, keep your questions until the end of part one, and then we have a break. It's always good to have a break, but you know, such a long lecture. Then we discuss things a little bit, and then I go on with part two. Each of these parts should take about 30 minutes. One maybe 40 minutes, and the other 20, we'll see how it goes. So, supply-demand analysis, which is an analysis that I developed together with my colleague Ethel Cornish-Bowden over a question of about 15 years. Remember, I showed you the metabolic map in the previous lecture. This is a different view because what often is not realized is that if one looks at this map, it has endpoints. It produces stuff. The endpoints being, and I'll show it just now, but say amino acids and nucleotides and fatty acids and so on, but it doesn't end with this intermediate metabolism. This is only a part of the cell that produces stuff to be used by other processes in the cell. That's why I say that actually the metabolic reaction network is a collection of molecular factories. And I'm going to use the idea of a factory right throughout as an analogy. So let us just have a look at this idea of a factory. As we know, a factory is something that some other structure that takes in raw materials and then transforms these raw materials into certain products. Now, if you're an engineer and you have to design a factory, and you then rock up with your plans at some board meeting where you now explain what your factory is going to do, and a board member asks you, and what happens if the demand for your product goes up or the demand for your product goes down, and you haven't considered this in the design of your factory, you'll be laughed out of the boardroom. Huh? So you need to, of course, in the construction of the factory and designing how the processes work, you need to take consumer demand into account. And of course, what you want to the factory to be respond to is that if the consumer demand falls, that you don't just keep on producing product, which will heap up and heap up in your storeroom. So there must be some other mechanism in which the product concentration, as it increases, is sensed by the system, and in that way shuts down the production until the consumer demand increases again and the factory goes on. Of course, this is not a very good way of doing it. It would be much better if you did that, so that you made the first step in your factory sensitive to the amount of product. There could be a little guy in between that counts the product and then it just puts in a switch, but it doesn't matter how it works. But you have to think of that. The problem is, if you look at what happened in classical view of regulation, the classical conception of regulation, that people forgot about the demand. And I want to show you today what happens if you take demand into account inside the cell. So first I want to then talk about this idea of the importance of functional context. And it's a very human thing to do. I mean, when we study a system, you have to draw a boundary somewhere. You have to decide what's inside the system and what is outside the system that you regard as environment. usually what has happened in metabolism, because it is such a hugely complex network, people isolate bits of the metabolism to study. And that's perfectly fine. We have to do that. So you isolate the enzymes, you perhaps make an in vitro model, or you have in vivo techniques that you study how the system behaves. But basically you do this. And if P was an amino acid, for instance, this agrees exactly, and you'll remember, those of you that did biochemistry, this is the way it's in the textbook. The pathway stops at the amino acid, or the nucleotide, or the fatty acid, and it's called an end product. As if it is really an end product. Of course it's not, it's an intermediary product. It's used for something else. Amino acids are used for protein synthesis, and nucleotides for polynucleotide synthesis, etc. So what you should be doing is to take the functional context into account. So you've already heard Dobzhansky's mantra, yeah? Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. That's fine if you study organisms over lineages and time. But if you're studying a single organism and you want to figure out how it works, you want proximal explanations, as Ernst Mayr said, instead of ultimate explanations, then my mantra is nothing in an organism, in an organism, makes sense except in the light of functional context. I cannot understand the properties of what I have there as the system if I do not take into account that the product of that system is used for something else inside. And I have to actually make a system that contains both. I have to expand the system. So I must both look into the system to analyze, that's fine, that's what we've been doing, but we also have to look out. Very important. And the looking out bit is the bit that has not been done. So the problem is you analyze the system by looking in, and then you expect the properties that you see there to remain exactly the same when you put the thing into its wider context. And the snag is it doesn't. So for instance, I'll show you that if step one is a rate limiting step, and there are good reasons why in that little subsystem it must have a high flux control coefficient. If it didn't, remember the response coefficient? If it has to respond to P, which is the response coefficient, it must have a local effect that's given by the feedback loop. So it must be, the enzyme 1 must be sensitive to P, but it must also have a high control coefficient in that system in order for it to have an effect on the flux. So there are good reasons for it to be a rate-limiting step, if I use that term, in that system. However, I'll show you, if I put it into functional context, its flux control coefficient is 0. Has no rate-limiting effect whatsoever. The control sits outside, and I'll show you how that works. So in fact, intermediary metabolism is, as I said, a collection of factories that make products for macromolecular synthesis and growth. These products are what are called end products, which I just described. And of course, chemical energy in the form of gradients of ATP, ADP, or UTP, UDP, whatever. They are used in different, so just general nucleotide triphosphate, nucleotide diphosphate ratios. So that's what the product of intermediate metabolism is. So in fact, what we should be looking at is intermediate metabolism as a supply system, and then the macromolecular growth processes as demand systems. So it's really like a human economy, except that it works inside the cell and it doesn't work for humans. Classical economic theory, as we now very well know in the last number of years, doesn't work. Why? Because classical equilibrium economic theory rests on the absolute basic assumption that humans are rational agents and that they will all behave in the same way under a certain set of circumstances. Nothing is further from the truth. But in a cell, a population of a certain enzyme, all those molecules will behave exactly the same under a certain set of conditions. And so you have rational agents inside the cell, if you want to use the word agents, for molecule, for enzymes. And I think of them as agents, as things that do something, that act. Right, so what is this organization then, this functional organization which we have to take into account? This is very general, but it's a bird's eye view that we have, because we have to step back. We know all the details, but we have to make sense of it by stepping back. And all living systems, all cells have at least what I'm going to show you now, this sort of structure. You have a catabolic pathway, or pathways, that take in food and converts the food into carbon dioxide and carbon skeletons. You'll see there triose, tetrose, pentose, so C3, C4, C5, C6 carbon skeletons. That, and of course it produces chemical energy in the form of a high ATP-ADP ratio and reducing power in the form of a high NADPH-NADP ratio. That is a factory, and those are the products of the factory. That are then used by consumers inside the cell. The first consumer is biosynthesis, which converts these carbon skeletons into what are then called the end products of intermediary metabolism. Amino acids, nucleotides, fatty acids, etc. So here you have a supply system and a demand system coupled by various intermediary products. Those end products are then used in growth processes to produce the macromolecular molecules like proteins and nucleic acids, and of course complex lipids that are then used to make membranes, etc. Of course, when you're a plant, you have another photosynthetic module added onto it, and so. But in principle, this is the core of intermediary metabolism that all living systems have. And you can see it is a series of linked factories that serve as supply and demand for each other. And I'm going to focus in this lecture on this factory, the factory between biosynthesis and growth. So this is the factory that produces these products, and this is the demand process that uses these products to make other things. Right, that's the functional organization of metabolism. The nice thing about it, if you look at it, is that either the factories, the supply and demand, are coupled in a linear way, so you have a biosynthetic supply, for instance, that makes a metabolic end product, such as an amino acid, and then you have a growth demand. In this case, it will be protein synthesis if it was an amino acid. The other type of coupling is a cyclic coupling, so for instance, between a catabolic supply and an anabolic demand, coupled by ATP-ADP couple. And the whole of this functional organization is built up out of these two cycles. And the nice thing is you can analyze both of them as just a simple supply-demand system. Doesn't look like it, but the point is here, because the sum of these two concentrations are always the same, because it's a moiety-conserved cycle. You can see there's an ADP moiety in there as well. It's just phosphorylated, which means that the sum of, it's always the same ATP, unless ADP is made de novo, but that's much, much slower than the rate of cycling. So one can regard these two as constant, the concentrations, the sum of them. Then if you work with a ratio of these two, it becomes the variable that couples the two. So you can either work, in this case, with a one product concentration, or here you can work with a ratio. But we can analyze the system as a linear supply-demand system, whether it's cyclic or not. And that's very useful. So, you'll see now why I, in my previous lecture, used in my explanation of control analysis the enzyme 1 and enzyme 2 to explain what a control coefficient and an elasticity coefficient is. Because in principle, this is exactly the same, except instead of having enzyme 1 and enzyme 2, I have block 1 and block 2. Supply block, demand block, linked then by some other product that is produced by the one and consumed by the other. So the analysis is exactly the same. I can still use my nice two-step system in order to figure out what the properties. So is this a general? No, it's not general. Something went boom.
The market crashed, actually.
The market crashed. It's very difficult for me to explain without the diagrams. So, would you have some patience? Let me see whether you can fix this. But if you want to at this stage, and if there are any questions, we might as well discuss them. But it's a rather general information at this stage. So.
then
this theory in a long series of papers was developed by Ethel Cornish Bowden and myself. Ethel was in, when I met him in Birmingham at the university, and subsequently moved to Marseille, where he's at the CNRS in France. I gave you, I think, two papers from that series, but the rest, I mean, if anybody wants any more papers, I have them all available. I just didn't know how many I should load the system with, so I wasn't sure at the stage that I submitted the papers. This is a recent paper that a review that was published last year with my colleague Johan Rover, which is a combination of the classic, our classical development that we made, plus a generalization, and then also discussing all the experimental evidence, of which I'll give you some that was subsequently done. Right, so you remember this picture. This is a supply and demand rate characteristic picture, which shows you how how sensitive, or the sensitivity of the supply system to the product concentration and the demand system to, with respect to the product, its substrate concentration. And at the steady state, remember, we are interested in the slopes to those curves, the slopes of the tangents to those curves, because they allow us then to figure out what the control properties are. And these are elasticity coefficients, and I shall use them from now on as well. So that was the solution to the system. We saw that if you added the two control flux control coefficients together, that all of these expressions have the same denominator. And if you add these two together, they sum to one. And if you add these two together, the P concentration control coefficients, they sum to zero. So you can see they have the same, obviously because they have to sum to zero and they're only two, they have the same absolute value. The one is positive and the other one is negative. So, what I'm going to explain to you now is how two of the most important metabolic functions, control of flux and control of concentration, depend on those slopes, on those elasticity coefficients. Of course, there are other metabolic functions, such as control of transition time between states, which is very important, but which I'm not going to look at all at this afternoon. But it's something that one should also study. Of course, also the determination of the form of the dynamic attractor, whether it's a point attractor in steady state, as we know it, or a limit cycle, or a strange attractor. And also, very important, the stability of the attractor. But again, those that I have marked in black are topics that won't fit into this afternoon's discussion. We actually don't need them for this discussion. So now I want to talk a little bit about the idea of functional differentiation. So, remember that we were able to derive a property called the connectivity property between control coefficients and elasticity coefficients. And if you rewrite the so-called flux connectivity property, you find out that the ratio of elasticities determines the distribution of flux control. Remember, the two flux control coefficients must sum up to one, and their ratio is determined by the slopes. That is a negative slope to start off with, and the minus just makes it positive, because both of these, of course, are positive coefficients. So look, if we look at a special case, let's ask ourselves, how do we obtain flux control by step two? And the answer is, if you want all the flux control to reside there, then that elasticity, at least the absolute value of it, must be much larger than that elasticity. And under those conditions, the flux control coefficient of step 2 will tend towards 1, and the flux control coefficient of step 1 will tend towards 0. Under those conditions, The step two will be rate limiting in the real sense of the word when it has a flux control coefficient of 1. But of course, if the elasticity values are the same, then control is distributed 50-50 between the two steps. Remember this, distribution of flux control is determined by the ratio of the elasticities. On the other hand, the magnitude of the concentration control is determined by the sum of the elasticities. And we can see this as well from the expressions. These were the expressions in terms of elasticities for these two coefficients. You can see the one has the same value as the other, except the one is positive, the other is negative, and they depend on the sum of these elasticities. I could have written it as EV2P plus the absolute value of epsilon, V1P. So let us take our previous condition where we wanted flux control by step 2. And under those conditions, that elasticity had to be much, much smaller than that elasticity. What does this mean in terms of, what does it mean for concentration control? So if you look at that sum, and this is negligible with respect to that one, then you can cancel it. And in the end, can you see that the flux control coefficients depend only on one elasticity? And that is the elasticity of this block. So already we can see here a truism arising, which is always so. If you have such a supply-demand system, and the flux control is in one step, then the concentration control, the degree of concentration control, is determined by the other step. You can't get away from that. You can't have both those metabolic functions, flux control and determination of the degree of concentration control, you can't have that in the same step. If the one takes over flux control, the other one must have the if one takes over flux control, the other must take over the control of concentration. And that's extremely important. That means function gets differentiated between two. Now, of course, this is algebraic, and some people don't like to see algebra. I can do this much nicer using the rate characteristics. So I want to show now how, stepwise, I want to functionally differentiate these two systems, starting off with a system which is functionally undifferentiated. So I've constructed a system here where the rate characteristics have the same values for the slopes, one positive, one negative, but the same absolute values. And I consider an experiment in which I change the activity of the demand up and down by a certain percentage, and I do the same for the supply. And you can see the effect that it has on the flux, which is given by the height of this bar, is exactly the same in both cases. Which means that the flux control coefficient of the supply is 0.5, and that one of the demand is also 0.5. So in terms of flux control, it's undifferentiated. In terms of concentration control, you can see whether you change the demand or the supply, doesn't matter, they have exactly the same values. They must, in fact, always have exactly the same values. But in terms of flux control, undifferentiated. So remember that we said that the sum of elasticities determines the degree of concentration control. So let me now change the situation so that I now still have a functionally undifferentiated system in terms of flux control, because the slopes are still the same, but I've made the slopes much shallower. And can you see what happens to the degree of change in the concentration of B? This is narrow, this is extremely broad. So the larger the sum, in this case, the smaller the concentration variation. And the smaller the sum of the slopes, the larger the variation. So this is a way of describing homeostasis in P. So this would be good homeostasis in the P concentration. That would be bad homeostasis in a relative sense now compared to that. So here you have huge variation in the concentration of P for a specific perturbation. Here you have a small variation in P. And of course, a lot of what happens in metabolism is exactly that, is to try and keep the variation in concentrations, number one, as small as possible, and also to keep the concentrations as low as possible, because of what I previously said, is that there is a limited solvent capacity in the cell for solutes. In other words, if one solute rises too high, then the cell becomes sick. So because you have thousands of metabolites, the regulatory strategies is to keep them as low as possible. And so here we have a nice example of this. The consequences of having shallow slopes or steep slopes of elasticity. So that's the one thing. Some of elasticities determines magnitude of concentration control. The ratio of elasticities determines the distribution of the flux control, as I said before, but this is nicely demonstrated here. So what I've done here is I've kept the same slope for the demand, but I've made the supply slope much shallower. So now the supply slope, the supply elasticity, is smaller than the demand elasticity, and we've said that would shift the flux control to the supply, yeah? As you can see here. If I vary the demand here, I have a very small change in the flux, but if I vary the supply, I have a much larger change in the flux. So that the supply in this particular case has more control over the flux. Whereas, as I said there, if the supply-demand elasticity ratio is less than 1, flux control shifts to the supply. The other way around, if the supply-demand elasticity ratio is larger than 1, the flux control shifts to the demand. As you can see here, now I change the demand by that same amount, and I have a large change in the flux, and if I do the same percentage change for the supply, I have a very small change in the flux. So that's an important point. Okay, this is just to show an even... So here I have quite a bit of control in the demand, and I make this slope even steeper, then you can see there's virtually no control over the flux in the supply. Everything sits in the demand. And now comes this interesting point. If it is so that most of the flux control sits in the demand, then remember what we said, the function of concentration control shifts to the other block. And you can see it clearly. It's the slope of the supply rate characteristic that determines how broad this band is. And the steeper that slope is, the narrower the band. So this maintenance of the degree of homeostasis in P under conditions where there is flux control by the demand is completely the function of the supply. The supply determines how much P varies. And the steeper that slope, the better. The better the homeostasis in P. Those are the essential elements of supply-demand analysis. And so the central insight, which I take as a take-home message, if the demand controls the flux, the supply determines the degree of homeostasis of a linking product concentration, and of course vice versa. It doesn't have to be flux control by demand, it can be flux control by supply. But then the demand takes over this function of determining the degree of homeostasis. One block cannot do both. Very important. This was something that was never realized in classical view of regulation.
But to have both controls distributed
over both supply and demand? Yes, as we had in the beginning here, no? There, that situation. And this situation. There you have flux control over both. But the point is, in terms of functionality, it doesn't make sense from a functional point of view to have that. So what we find experimentally is that either the flux control sits in the supply or the demand. Very seldom do you have it distributed between the two. If we look now at these, our intermediate metabolism is coupled to, say, growth processes. So, a few experimental examples of experimental evidence for flux control by demand. This is simple. You can go and look at the Salmonella and E. coli Bible, although they've left it out in the new edition, but the old, fortune teller still had the old edition, which still had some good metabolism in it before the genetics took over. If you look at a supply process that leads to an amino acid in general, what would be the first step in protein synthesis? It would be the activation of the amino acid to form aminoacyl tRNA by these set of enzymes, aminoacyl tRNA synthetases. And what we find is that the Km, the Michaelis constant, which is a measure of how strongly the enzyme binds, in this case the amino acid, is extremely low. In other words, if you have a substrate concentration which is the millimolar range and the Km is in the micromolar range, which is a thousandfold difference between the two, then certainly this enzyme will be completely saturated with the amino acid. And if an enzyme is saturated with its substrate, elasticity coefficient is zero. And remember what we said is if the demand elasticity is very small relative to the supply elasticity, all the flux control sits in the demand. And it turns out that, as I said, this is saturated, and of course we have all these feedback loops in intermediate metabolism from the amino acids to previous steps. And most amino acid pathways are regulated in that way. And these give a negative feedback where the elasticity is high. So you have a high supply elasticity and a very small demand elasticity, which ensures that all the flux control sits here, and that the role of the supply has got absolutely nothing to do, and the role of the feedback loop, nothing to do with flux regulation, which is the statement made in classical regulation view. It's got nothing to do with flux regulation. It has everything to do with keeping that homeostatic and far away from equilibrium. I'll come back to this again. This was the first really nice experimental verification of the supply by flux control by demand idea. Brian Koopman in the group of Peter Jensen at the DTU in Denmark, together with Hans Westerhoff and Jackie Snoop, my colleague at Stellenbosch, and another student in the Journal of Bacteriology in 2002, they showed, looking at the effect of growth demand on glycolysis. And they, of course, coupled by ATP. So they showed that the ATP demand actually controls the glycolytic supply. So there's no very little flux control in glycolysis, contrary to what you would read in any biochemistry textbook, which would tell you that in E. coli, the control of flux sits in three kinases, mostly in the phosphofructokinase. What they showed is nonsense. In this particular case, no flux control in glycolysis, all of it in the demand. You can see that demand elasticity is extremely low and the supply, glycolytic supply, is higher. So this was the first demonstration, or verification actually, of our prediction that this should be so. And there was a nice quote in Nature by Steve Oliver, which said that this experimental validation could mean that biologists in the 21st century need a rethink of their view of the cellular economy that is every bit as radical as that initiated for political economy by John Stuart Mill and William Stanley Jevons in the 19th century. Quite nice to read something like that when your theory is verified. Since then, there have been many experiments. Here's a nice one because it shows something different. This was done in our lab by Ottini Krookamp under the leadership of Johan Rover, and they looked at supply demand analysis of anaerobic yeast energy metabolism. So this is glucose limited, very low glucose, anaerobic chemostat conditions in which they grew the yeast and did the control analysis. And there they found that most of the flux control sits in the supply and not in the demand. But these are very special conditions where the glucose concentration is low, and apparently we know now that the glucose transporter does have some degree of flux control. So under those conditions, the demand is so that it does not control the flux as much as the supply. So it shows you another very important thing, is that this distribution of control is not a fixed thing. It depends on the conditions. Under certain conditions, a step may have control over the flux. Under other conditions, may not have any control.
Sorry, quick question. Is demand in these experiments essentially the ATP-ADP ratio? Are you talking?
The linking product, if you want to call it that, is the ATP-ADP ratio. The demand is the rate at which ATP is utilized. So in this case, what they do is they add an uncoupler so that it wastes ATP. In that sense, they can increase the demand for ATP. Of course, this is important for biotechnology, because if you want to manipulate the cell, as I said previously, you must know where to manipulate. And so for yeast, and we all want to manipulate yeast, a baker wants it to make more carbon dioxide, and a distiller wants to make more ethanol. Right, so. We proposed, Ethel Cornish Bowden, myself, and Mary Lou Cardenas, his wife, some strategies for manipulating fluxes in biotechnology, but here is a nice example, glycolysis. So there we have glucose, goes down to ethanol and carbon dioxide, and if you would ask most people, what is the product of glycolysis, what would you say? Are you a baker or are you a distiller? pyruvate, it's like with pyruvate goes to ethanol and carbon dioxide, so you're hedging your bets, yeah? Come on.
Ethanol.
No? Yeah, of course, it is a product. But from the cell's point of view.
ATP.
Yes! Thank you, Albert. ATP. But very few people realize this. So they think that, we want to increase the rate of production of ethanol. What must we do? We must manipulate this pathway. And so where are the rate limiting steps? Well, there they are, according to the textbook. And so we have to overexpress those enzymes. It was done in 1989 by a group in Jülich, Walter Zimmermann's group, by his PhD student Irene Schaaf. And she set about doing this. And she cloned all of those enzymes and started overexpressing them. And overexpressing them one by one, absolutely nothing happened. No increase in the flux, no increase in any concentrations, zilch. Then she thought, okay, maybe I should start doing some of them in pairs. And so she started using some of them and overexpressed them in pairs. Nothing happened. Nothing that she could do by overexpressing enzymes and glycolysis had any effect on the flux. And then they speculated, the control must be shared. Dogma. Control must be shared over all of the steps of the system, so none of them will have really control over the flux by themselves. Or maybe the transporter has flux control. And that one, they didn't test, but that one turned out to be quite important. The transporter can have flux control. But what they all forgot is that glycolysis is not a linear pathway. It is one arm of a cycle. The other arm of the cycle being the demand for ATP. And so if you do want to increase the flux to ethanol, and this has been done in other experiments, you have to increase the demand. You have to pull. Remember, you don't have to push. So what do? Is you create a leak. And this was very beautifully done by Peter Jensen, the same group that did those experiments originally, in that they had a way of dissociating the F0, F1 ATPase so that they only had the F1 ATPase as a soluble protein. Of course, then it acts as a ATPase, not as an ATP synthetase, as you have in mitochondria. And so they introduce this into the cell, and then you can have an increase in glycolysis. So as you increase the internal leak, you pull more, then glycolysis obliges by making ethanol and carbon dioxide faster. Oh, nice. So this is the end of part one.
And we can ask a few questions. So could it also work by sort of removing ethanol really quickly from the cell? No, because ethanol goes out by itself very quickly. So there's not even a transporter for ethanol. Ethanol is dissolved. It's because it's rather like filling. It needs to go through the membrane. And carbon dioxide as well. So no, you can't pull the system by, because there's no feedback from ethanol onto the system. Pulling it doesn't help. The system doesn't sense the concentration of ethanol. So that won't help. No, this is the way to do it.
So it's not strictly pulling, it's pulling something that has a feedback.
Yes, you're pulling something that relieves the feedback, actually. So the question is whether in the calculations I've taken into account the biochemical properties of the enzyme. These are not calculations, of course, these are experimental. But in what is going to follow? Yes, so in what is going to follow, I'm going to give you a model in which we try to keep as closely as possible to the known properties of biochemical of the enzymes.
Right. My point was, in these calculations, do you include regulatory mechanisms that operate at the genetic level?
Yes, we'll get to that now. That's what my whole next part is going to be about. It's going to be a construction of a subsystem which contains most of the regulation that we know about. Okay. Metabolic level, genetic level.
Right, because you take
they also kept apart usually.
Yeah. Well, in the case of, for example, tryptophan biosynthesis, you have three levels. You have feedback inhibition, you have feedback repression, then you have the explicit regulation by
so, so tryptophan is a co-repressive.
Yeah. The enzyme is also inhibited by tryptophan. In addition,
So tryptophan feeds back onto the first enzyme in its pathway.
Right.
And it also acts as a co-repressor.
Exactly.
To induce, under low tryptophan conditions, to induce the synthesis of the enzymes.
Right.
In fact, there's an operon there.
Yeah.
The tryptophan operon, so it induces all the enzymes.
those factors also will get.
Yes, up to now, no calculations whatsoever. Up to now, it's just general. So we must ask now, what causes these slopes, the steepness of the slopes? And that's what now I'm going to give you a detailed model that shows that.
Can you move to the previous slide, factory analog, starting slide?
This one?
Previous, starting.
Which one?
First analogy.
Raw material, factory and analogy. Yeah.
This one?
No, the first slide.
The very first slide.
It's the very first slide.
Yeah.
The one with those orange dots on.
Probably, yeah.
This is part of extra time, actually.
Yeah.
That one. Oh, not this.
No. Yes. Yeah. Suppose we have now a protein, we have tyrosine is utilized for protein synthesis. Tyrosine is also utilized for thyroid hormone synthesis. Now, if tRNA amino acyl tRNA tyrosine is not able to synthesize tRNA with what we call tyrosine,
yeah.
It will, as per your view, the demand supply will be low now.
Sorry, again?
Supply will be low.
The supply will be low.
Yeah. It will not affect the other pathways.
So what you're saying is that there's a product and you have more than one consumer pathway.
Yeah.
Okay, and then?
Suppose one consumer pathway is affected. Will it affect the other consumer pathway?
Yeah, if the concentration of the product changes, yes. But this is all stuff that I'm now going to show you explicitly.
Because we have another case where HGPRT hormone, which converts hypoxanthine to what we call guanine. That is hypoxanthine, if that enzyme is defective, that will not lead to the regulation of supply. In turn, that is affected, that is converted to uric acid, that leads to disordered conditions. That is what.
Okay. So there are trillions of examples, and I don't know all of them, so I mean, one has to, each particular example has to be analyzed on its own. They all have their idiosyncrasies and slight differences. So I cannot comment on that. But what I can give you now, in the next section, if I may go on with it, is that okay?
One question. Isn't the making one of the slope, close to zero, similar to making a red unit instead?
Yes, exactly. If one of the slopes is zero, you have that step is a red unit, completely. But it's the ratio of the slope. So if the other slope is also very close to zero, then you have an incredibly sensitive system. And again, maybe not a complete replication. But usually you have one slope low and the other one as steep as possible because that gives you good information. Shall I go on? Is that okay?
Up to now, I've been considering such a process, a biosynthetic process, and there's metabolic feedback. So enzyme 1 is an allosteric enzyme, which has a binding site for P, And in this case, if the concentration of P goes up, it affects the activity in an inhibitory way. So the activity of the enzyme decreases. What we do know, of course, is for many of these products, you have also a level of regulation at the genetic level. So where P then acts as a co-repressor with respect to a particular repressor and forms a repressor, co-repressor complex, which then binds to the operator region of the DNA and prevents the transcription of DNA into mRNA. So I've just indicated that by a negative feedback loop. The mRNA, of course, is transcribed to form the enzyme. So this is the synthesis of the enzyme of this step. And I also have in here the degradation of that enzyme. Of course, I could have done it for all the enzymes, but just this is a model that demonstrates things. So I didn't want to make it that complicated. This is a generic model, or a toy model in a sense. But we try to incorporate all the real biochemical properties. We're very, very careful that the enzyme equations that we use do not preclude certain forms of control and that they actually agree with what we know of 100 years of study of enzymes. Now, I'm going to consider two demands. It's GD. I should have made them white, but I didn't get time to do that. But that's the growth demand. So all of these products, like an amino acid, is used in some other macromolecular synthesis. But of course, most of them also have a catabolic demand. So an amino acid can be used for protein synthesis, but it can also be broken down. So here we have an example of two consuming steps. And we'll see, and I want to show you how you can form a picture of the regulation of this system using rate characteristics. So the tools, I'm going to simplify slightly, I'm going to simplify this rather complicated system just into a protein synthesis step and a protein degradation step and an inhibitory effect on that. Because it was not important for the demonstration to have all the details of the genetic regulation in there, you just have inhibition, that is all that is important. But for the enzymes here, it was very important that we used realistic enzyme rate equations. All of these tools were used in the construction of the model and the analysis of the model. Very important, we have our own computational platform called PiSeS. It's the Python simulator for cellular systems, which we wrote to simulate these pathways and also do the control analysis. Brett Ulefier, my PhD student, spent years writing this program, and it's extremely useful. It's open source, anybody can use it. And if you want to play around with it, ask me. I can tell you how to do it. So, first of all, I had to construct a model of the supply-demand system. So what we used to indicate or to describe the first step is what we call the reversible Hill equation with a modifier. I'll show you now what it looks like. And then ordinary reversible Michaelis-Menten equations for the enzymes 2 and 3. And then just an irreversible Michaelis-Menten equation for the demand, because we didn't consider anything that happened after it to immediately feed back. May have been an oversight or too much of a simplification, but it works for this particular situation. We have to use reversible enzyme equations because we have to allow for mass action to have a feedback effect, because this is realistic. All chemical reactions are in principle reversible. As soon as you build an irreversible equation into this, then you immediately affect the control properties. You sort of preempt the control properties. So that is why the Hill equation has always been an irreversible equation when you find it in the literature. So we had to go about trying to figure out a new way. So the other thing is, we need to know what the limits of the system is. So I clamped this at a value of 1. So the concentration is 1 concentration unit. Equilibrium constant here is 1,000 and then 10 and 10, which means that the overall equilibrium is 10 to the 5. So if I keep this at 1, the equilibrium concentration, if I clamp this at 1 and I push up product, by the time I get to 10 to the 5, I would have reached equilibrium for that subsection from S to P. So we didn't have these equations. You can see, in order to do what I show you today, we had to develop whole new things. We had to develop new enzyme kinetics in order to do this computational systems biology type of experiment. So there's a lot of years and years of work that went into the construction of the tools that we had to use. So this is the reversible Hill equation with an allosteric modifier. You have a capacity term that determines the Vmax of the enzyme. You have a regulatory term which determines how the substrate and the immediate product A and the modifier B, how it affects the rate of the enzyme. And then you have a thermodynamic factor at the end, where the distance from equilibrium determines to a degree the rate. So it's the contribution of thermodynamics to the measured rate. So the S0.5 is the half saturation concentration of S, which for a Michaelis Menten would be the Km. And for A it's the same, and for P it's the same. It's the half saturation concentrations. So it's in the absence of the others, the concentration of that species necessary to half saturate the enzyme, 50% of the enzyme molecules in the bound form. K cat is the catalytic rate constant. H is the Hill coefficient, which appears there, 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 and there. This is the modifier strength, and if it's less than one, you have an inhibitory effect. If it's much less than one, approaching zero, then you have competitive inhibition. If it's larger than one, it's activation, which I'm not going to consider. And if it's zero, then there is no allosteric effect. You can see if that is zero, then you have one here, then this reduces to one. And K is the equilibrium constant, the KEQ. So, what are the rate characteristics of such a regulated biosynthetic supply looks like? So this is supposed to be what a realistic rate characteristic would look like over the whole variation of concentration range of P from very low to its equilibrium value. So this is when there is when this feedback is not there, but it's like that factory that I showed you, that P, as it heaps up, has a feedback effect on its producing enzyme through a kinetic effect and also through mass action effects. And then B builds up and it has an effect, and A builds up and has an effect. It's a sluggish mechanism, and of course, as P builds up, all these other guys also build up with it. So it's not a very good mechanism. But what you see what happens, if the binding strength of P to its product and to its enzyme, and B to its enzyme and A to its enzyme is very small, so it is a large dissociation constant, then this is what it looks like. For most of the range of concentration of P, it has no effect on the rate through the system, no effect on the flux, until you get close to equilibrium, and then of course the value has to go to zero, because in equilibrium the net value, the net rate is zero. So nothing happens there, and then it falls down. If you start making this effect, the sensitivity higher and higher and higher, then it shifts like this. Then the reaction rate or the flux is more sensitive at lower concentrations of P. But this is a very, the slope is one, it's not a high slope, not a high elasticity. This would be a very bad way of regulating the system. However, if you have a feedback loop like this, where enzyme 1 is sensitive to P, then this is the profile. And you can see there is now a range of P around here at very low concentrations relative to the equilibrium concentration. So here, say orders of magnitude away, where the rate is very sensitive to P. Clearly here, that's the maximal flux carrying capacity of the system. Can't go faster than that. But in this range, variation in P will actually inhibit the rate quite strongly. And now what is nice, you can play around as a god, as an engineer. You can play around with these parameters to see how do they shape that curve. So if you were able to be evolution and with evolution mold that curve, which parameters would you mold to get a particular shape to the curve? So for instance, the Hill coefficient determines how steep that curve is. And of course, remember, this is a log-log plot. So what is that slope there? It is the elasticity of the supply. So at any point, the slope on this curve is the elasticity of the supply. So here we have, as the Hill coefficient go up, an extremely steep elasticity. Right, so that's what the Hill coefficient does. The modifier strength alpha, remember in our, the one there, that one. What that does, if it's one, there is no allosteric effect. And as it becomes smaller and smaller, you can see it pulls down the bottom range of the bottom of the range in which the enzyme is actually sensitive to P. So there you can see that it's sensitive to P, but only for, say, one order of magnitude. But as alpha becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, you pull it down so that you have a whole wide orders of magnitude range in which the flux can be regulated by P. And if it's zero, this just goes down and down and down and down and down and down. It's a competitive inhibitor. And it's strange, I mean, those of you who know a little bit about enzyme kinetics, usually the equation that is used in modeling is the so-called Monod-Wyman-Changeur model for allosteric effects. And it's usually one in which alpha, effectively, there is no alpha in there, but the effect is as if the alpha is zero. And people don't realize that under those conditions, the allosteric modifier is actually not allosteric, it's just an ordinary competitive inhibitor. And that's not how it usually works. So the point is that we had to figure out whether this is actually realistic, this profile. And we studied at least one particular enzyme, pyruvate kinase, and this is exactly the profile that we got. Is that it didn't go like this. At some stage it leveled off. And so there is an upper level and a lower level in the range in which the flux can be regulated. And so these cause two regulatory problems. What happens if the P goes so low that you end up here? And what happens if the P goes so high that you end up here somewhere? You don't want to be here, and here you want to increase the capacity in some way. The binding strength of P to the enzyme determines where this regulation takes place, in which part of the concentration range. And of course, the stronger it binds, the further away from equilibrium the regulation takes place. And this is, of course, what the cell would like. It doesn't want pre-concentrations of 10 to the 5. You want to be able to regulate the flux at concentrations far from equilibrium. Right? And this is exactly what can be achieved by making P bind stronger and stronger and stronger to the enzyme. Then you shift this curve in this direction. If you increase the strength with which S, or you change the strength at which S binds to the enzyme, then you also shift this up and down. You can see when at very low S0.5, so effectively a very low Km, when the enzyme is saturated with S, no matter what the concentration of P, you eliminate the allosteric effect. This was also completely new. This is a phenomenon we call the modifier saturation effect. And this is something that wasn't realized before that it could be. So it's important for the cell. Remember, you read in textbooks that enzymes are usually operating with a substrate concentration at about half the limiting concentration, at about the half saturation concentration. And you can see then we're around here. If it had to operate at a high concentration, saturating concentration, you would lose the feedback effect of P. So this was quite an interesting phenomenon that we discovered in this equation. And of course, if you move the enzyme concentration up and down, then the whole curve shifts up and down. You change the capacity. But you can see it doesn't change the size of the range in which the flux can be regulated. Right. So you can see how we can play around with the properties of such an enzyme to get a feeling for the possibilities for molding this curve. And so we see that the enzyme concentration determines that bit. The kinetics of the enzyme, the Hill coefficient and the binding strength, determine where this lies and how steep it is. Enzyme kinetics, the alpha determines how high or how low that plateau lies there, and then thermodynamics determines this part of the pathway. Then kinetics doesn't play a role anymore, it's only thermodynamic. So, we have now a good idea of what determines what in the rate characteristic. So alpha is this, what we call the modifier strength, this term here, and it determines whether it's an inhibitor or an activator, number one. If it is smaller than one, it's an inhibitor. If it's larger than one, it's an activator. So, and it determines where this plateau lies relative to that. Yes. So now we add a demand to our system. We now know what the supply characteristics are of a typical, realistic supply system. Now we add the demand. So now, as we know, we have, and we're going to put in a demand that is saturated at very low concentrations of P, because this also now, as we know, agrees with experimental fact. So we have a steady state. And now we can ask ourselves, what would happen if I shift this demand up and down over the whole range? And so I have various regimes of flux control. If I increase the demand extremely high so that it exceeds the capacity of the supply, can you see I'm in this position now? Can you tell me where the flux control will now lie? Look at it. And look at what is the lowest elasticity, the smallest elasticity. It's the, no, no, look, at the elasticity of the supply is zero. And the elasticity of the demand is non-zero. That means that now the flux control in that condition sits in the supply. Right? So in this range, between 1 and 2, well, not 2, but a little bit more than 2, in that range, flux then the demand is so high that you've exceeded the flux carrying capacity of the supply, and the supply takes over control. Between 2 and 3, if you want to call it the designed range, the range in which regulation takes place. So a change in the concentration of P has a large effect on the flux through this subsystem, through the biosynthetic subsystem. Then if I increase P even further, then you go beyond the regulatory capacity of the system, and the system has no recourse but to jump to the near equilibrium branch. And then at very low demands, yeah, then P is extremely high, close to equilibrium. So this is the range in which regulation takes place. And this is this is kinetic regulation, that's thermodynamic regulation. So this system has been designed by me now, yeah, in order to have regulation in this concentration range of P. So as you can see, there are two problems. The one is, how do I cope with that problem, and how do I cope with this problem?
So between those two ranges, which would you prefer?
I want to be there.
Why not 4 to 5?
Because then the concentration of P is so high that the cell cannot handle those concentrations. Look, 10 to the 5 is a rather small equilibrium constant. For many biosynthetic pathways, the equilibrium constant can go up to 10 to the 16. Which means I have to now start walking from here.
I have to go somewhere outside here. And the cell just cannot handle those concentrations. The cell never wants anything to go near equilibrium, preferably.
No, that's wrong. Of course, there are certain reactions that are near equilibrium, but you don't want a fixed metabolite, something that is buffered by the system, which in this case it would be, and then have something that have a P go near equilibrium with respect to that value, which is what happens here. So this is sort of passive. Then the enzyme kinetics doesn't even count anymore. This is just purely thermodynamic regulation at extremely high values. So the idea of regulation is to be able to regulate the flux effectively, like here, at concentrations far away from equilibrium. And as we know also from the work of Albert and from Ilya Prigozhin, is that it's far from equilibrium that interesting things happen. Near equilibrium, the system is dead. All right. So this is just to show what happens if you do the experiment, which is often done in biotechnology, is you desensitize this enzyme with respect to the product. Look what happens now. This is your rate characteristic of the supply. And there is regulation, fantastic homeostasis. And so the homeostasis is the broadness of this band. And if I made that steeper, it will be better homeostasis. Excellent homeostasis here, fantastic homeostasis there, but at values close to equilibrium, which is not where we want to be. So this is why desensitizing an enzyme in biotechnology often leads to extremely sick organisms. They do produce extremely high concentrations of that product inside the cell, but they are virtually dead. Right, so let us solve this problem now. The problem of the upper capacity. So now I'm going to add in the genetic regulation as well. So I want to get rid of this problem. I still want the control in the demand at very low concentrations of P. And this is exactly what happens if you now add in a superstructure, a genetic superstructure of regulation here. So I have again this co-repressor-repressor complex that now inhibits the synthesis of the enzyme. And if the concentration of P goes very low, then the complex dissociates, you relieve the inhibition, and more enzyme is made. And you can see this is what happens. This is where we were before. And I've chosen the bindings, the dissociation constant here, in such a way that it kicks in this range here. So this is what the genetic regulation adds to it. And you can see it shifts the capacity up. So there's now more enzyme, and there's the possibility of now having regulation in this particular range as well. Of course, it's much slower. As I said, there's no time dimension in these graphs. This regulation is fast. That's going to take much slower. But once it's there, of course, then it works well. And now comes, for me, the interesting question. People spend their lives studying this little bit, and other people spend their lives studying that little bit, and nobody seems to ever ask if this is if these two systems, subsystems which are linked, have to work together harmoniously. Obviously, their parameters must be tuned to each other in some way, otherwise it doesn't work. Look what happens if I now change the binding strength here. Here it binds very strongly, so that you, sorry, it binds very weakly, so that, at low concentrations of P, you have the induction at very low concentrations of P. So sorry, P binds strongly to the... I'm getting confused now. P binds weakly. So here, you can see if I now start increasing the dissociation constant, then certainly I don't want it to happen there. Can you see? This is crazy. I want it to increase the capacity at the place where there's a regulatory problem. So it's no use having a dissociation constant of 1,000, because then I would have something that goes from there and then and kicks in here. Yeah? Here you can see how it agrees with the change in concentration of E. So if I were to design the system, I would say that I would tune the binding of P to this enzyme and the binding of P to the repressor in such a way that I have that graph going through one there. So then the regulation is as if it's continuous. Here it would kick in at too low concentrations of P, there it would kick in at too high concentrations of P. And so I'm waiting for someone who wants to do the experiments which will generate that rate characteristic so that we can see exactly how these two regulatory mechanisms work together, whether they are tuned to each other or not. Right. That would then if they were tuned to each other perfectly as I would think they should be, then it would give you this profile. It looks like a previous profile except at a much higher capacity, carrying capacity for flux. Right. In the last few minutes, I'm just going to show you what happens when we add this catabolic demand. Because what happens then, it solves the other problem, this problem. That if I take the demand too low, I jump to the near equilibrium branch. If I add the acatabolic demand, which is now going to be the red rate characteristic, then I've got two demands, and to get the total demand, I have to add the two curves together. That's the green curve, which is a sum of the blue. I've now, the original demand curve is now the blue one here that gave us a steady state there, and this is the catabolic demand, and if I add the two together I get a total demand, and of course the steady state is where the total demand and the supply have the same value. So that steady state is not there anymore, the steady state is now here. So I've solved the problem of jumping to this near equilibrium branch when I add a catabolic demand. So can you see what happens? Is that there is now, that is the flow through the growth demand here, that value, and here I have the flow through the catabolic demand. So I've created an overflow valve. So before the concentration of P goes up to very high values, it gets diverted into the catabolic demand. And now I can play around a little bit with the properties of the catabolic demand to see which would be good values for a good design. So for instance, if I ask myself, what happens if I now increase the demand? What would happen to the catabolic supply? So now you can see there's the new steady state, and now we have much less flowing. There's still a bit flowing through the overflow valve, but much less. If I have binding to catabolic demand which is too strong, so I shift catabolic demand to this side, then you can see what happens is that if I increase the demand, substantially more flows through the catabolic demand, which I don't want. I want the overflow valve to shut off when I increase the demand again. So this is not good design. If I make it even stronger, you can see that there's a lot flowing through the catabolic demand. On the other hand, if I make it too weak, like there, then you can see I already jumped to an order of magnitude higher P concentrations in the steady state there. And that's also not desirable in terms of the design of an overflow valve. Even better would be if I... this would be also for the weak binding still. So it is so that I can... If I increase the demand again, it's okay, but when I decrease the demand, then I have the steady state at too high a value of P. Making the Hill coefficient for the demand, in this case 4, I increase the steepness, the elasticity of the catabolic demand, and you can see then I have the situation that if I increase the flux, virtually nothing goes through the overflow valve. So it's again the P 0.5 value that is critical relative to all the other situations, and it's also the steepness of the curve which helps with the effectivity of the overflow valve. So I hope that I've shown you now that this is these are the experiments that we should be doing, and this is the way to depict them if we want to understand how all of the regulatory bits that we find around a metabolic junction such as P, how they all fit together. And so this is the challenge that I give to experimentalists, is don't only focus on one of these guys, try and put the whole picture together. Of course, we try to do this in models, but we don't always have all the experimental evidence that is needed to do this. So just to end off, classical view of regulation, I told you before, I showed this to you before. It says that these steps are the rate limiting steps in the cell. It says that the allosteric end product inhibition, the red arrows, enable the non-equilibrium enzymes to control the flux. Right? And then the near equilibrium steps transmit the fluxes effectively. It's not a caricature. This is really what, if you distill the classical view of regulation into a paragraph, this would be it. Look what happens when we add the demand. So we add a demand, that arrow should be going the other way. So demand processes for P1, P2, and P3. We've seen now that in this case, usually we find that the demand processes control the steady state flux. Not these yellow arrows here, but the green ones. The non-equilibrium supply enzymes, they maintain the homeostasis in P through this allosteric feedback loop. It's got nothing to do with flux regulation. It has to do with the maintenance of homeostasis in the linking metabolite concentrations. So that's, again, a complete turnover in the view. And then near equilibrium supply enzymes, what their role is, because they're usually very fast, near equilibrium, they keep the intermediate concentrations low and the transition time short. So this is, again, a whole set of other experiments or model experiments that show the role of these blue, what I've termed the blue enzymes here. So I hope that I've been able to show you how just looking at the system in its functional context changes our view completely of how the system is regulated and how it operates. So just to end up, these are my two colleagues in Stellenbosch at the Department of Biochemistry, Jacques Snoep and Johan Roover. This is no indication of the pecking order. It has to do with the fact, and I think Patrick told us about that, he is a Dutchman, yeah? So you know about how tall they are. He's got very strong German roots, and they're not far behind. And I'm just the shorty South African at the bottom. So, and I have to thank them for keeping my own work going. They are really fantastic colleagues. Thank you very much for listening.
I come back to my question. One of your slopes is small and the other one is big. And this is similar to rate limiting steps. So now I'm confused because you are putting rate limiting steps in the process, but then at the end you say, no, we shouldn't think in terms of rate limiting steps.
I told you I was going to do this. Right. If you read the literature, the idea of a rate limiting step is that it is somewhere in a pathway. It completely controls the flux. It has a flux control coefficient of 1. And it never changes. That's it. There's the pathway. There's the rate limiting step. But I've shown you that there can be rate limiting steps. There actually should be rate limiting steps. But they are in places. You have to first understand that the rate limiting step is determined by the system that you're looking at. And that if you change the system, the position of the rate limiting step can change. I've also shown that if you make the demand too high, it shifts within that system from the one to the other. So yes, you do need, and I would now say, you do need enzymes with high flux control coefficients in order to make regulation possible. If everything was just spread out and none of them really had a control flux control coefficient which is substantive, then you couldn't have regulation. So you do need them, but they shouldn't be a dogmatic rate limiting step like it was in the previous literature. So a pathway has a rate limiting step and that's it. But you need them.
Wondering about genetic feedback, because clearly if there are two regulatory pathways and they are at different rates, I mean temporal rates, then shouldn't you have to change the binding constant so that they sort of work in the same way? Because where you said was the one in your pathway, that's sort of assuming that they both work at the same temporal rate, no?
What should be the conditions in the cell at which the demand of ATP increase the supply? You have mentioned in the step 1 in this presentation that if the requirement of ATP increases in the cell, then the supply increases, that ethanol production may increase. You have mentioned this. So what will be the condition for that?
I'm not sure I follow exactly. So, under what condition would the demand for ATP in a cell go up?
Well, usually, the most important impetus for ATP in the consumption is, of course, growth. Yeah. So for a yeast that grows under anaerobic conditions, when there's very little glucose, then there's no growth taking place, and then the ATP demand is low. But as soon as you add a lot of glucose and the cell is happy and it wants to grow, then the demand for ATP goes up. So there are many processes that need ATP. So in metabolism itself, all the kinases need ATP. And you don't have to even think about only ATP, but UTP, which is used in certain biosynthetic processes, and GDP used in others. But it's mostly growth that determines it's the main determinant of ATP consumption. So all the processes that make macromolecules.
The plants need ATP. When the plants are in stress conditions, in the adverse conditions, at that time also they need more ATP.
Often under stress conditions, then the situation is so that it doesn't make enough ATP and the cell suffers because of that.
And of course, then the ATP concentration is lower, and then you may kick in some other processes, catabolic processes that provide new nutrients inside the cell to produce more ATP.
Okay, sir. And in our cases, we are studying the medicinal plants. When the plants are in very cold conditions, some plants produce more secondary metabolite in the stress condition. So then is this the same mechanism involved? That's why we are producing more secondary metabolites. Like the some plant is producing more terpenoids in the...
So the problem with secondary metabolism, of course,
we often... the secondary metabolites are often real end products. Yeah, so there's nothing consuming them. And they have some or other effects. Sometimes we don't even know what those effects are inside or outside the cell. So there it's a question of a supply pathway. There is no demand. And so one would expect that the regulation is at the beginning of the production of the secondary metabolite pathway. So under stress conditions, they get activated in some way. And they produce then metabolites. I mean, yeast does it with glycerol, for instance. It increases the glycerol concentration to protect itself against osmostress, for instance. But then there is a specific mechanism that kicks in as an activatory regulation and then leads to the increase in the product. So that's not the same as a supply-demand pathway. You only have a supply pathway in that sense.
I have a question. Following up on that, many secondary metabolites are used in cell-to-cell signaling. So it could well be that there's a demand there in the social context.
Yes, but except that demand is not a transformational demand. It's a signaling demand. And so there it doesn't get used up. Yeah. And so we have this problem in acetylcholine in synapses, right? There's a huge increase in the concentration when you have a synapse fiber. But of course, now the acetylcholine sits there. And so the two strategies, either reuptake if we have noradrenaline, for instance, take it up again into the presynaptic terminus, or that's like a stock out and you have an esterase that takes it away again. So the snail is set up in whatever, like what happens, it heaps up there, it makes a signal, but nothing takes it away usually. Unless there is some enzyme or some process that increases the concentration.
Just wanted to mention, the answer to the earlier question, when do you need more ATP? You said growth. Growth in the presence of glucose. But isn't that a circular argument? Because metabolizing glucose itself produces ATP. That's why there is growth. So why would growth demand more ATP from the system other than metabolic?
If you increase the growth rate, then it decreases the ATP relative to the ADP
But the growth is because of glucose.
No, it grows because glucose is available.
Right.
If there is no glucose, then the ATP ratio is so low that it inhibits growth processes.
Right. But the glucose metabolism itself generates ATP.
In conditions when there is demand for it.
Right.
So the point is it becomes very difficult to figure out what sits on what side and what is going
right
around the side part. So again, we model glycolysis to try and figure out exactly where the regulations lie and comparing different strategies with each other in order to figure out exactly how this works.
My point was this too.
My
feeling was that was a circular argument. That's why I wanted to hear.
It may be. We'll have to go think about it. But at the moment, I have to figure it out.
Sure.
Yeah,
shall we break for tea then and meet at 3:15 sharp? Sorry, one question. Please sharp, yeah.
So it may be out of context, but it has been always wobbling in my mind that why is ATP preferred over GDP and other nucleotides as a source of energy in our system? ATP is preferred as a source of energy in our system. Why not other nucleotides like GDP and all?
Yeah, I was putting up my hand because I don't have an immediate answer, but it's interesting that there are very defined processes. I mean, protein synthesis is about the only one that uses GTP as its energy source, and lipid synthesis is the only one that uses CTP, and carbohydrate synthesis is the only one that uses UTP. Why exactly, I don't know, but it must have something to do with a sort of chemical compartmentation in terms of moieties that are available for the food. Maybe it is a regulatory, makes the regulation easier in a sense. I don't know. I'm absolutely speculating.
Thanks then. So let's meet at 3:15 sharp, please.